First off, Betty, do you want to just let me know how you came to be at Greenham?
Well, I suppose I was already quite involved in peace movement and anti-nuclear things, and I'd occupied one of the people who'd occupied Luxillian in Cornwall before that, as well as Torness and campaigns about other things, waste dumping at sea off the Cornish coast. So it was a natural place for me to go in many ways. I suppose at that time I was almost a full-time protester, although I had a base in Cornwall that I lived at, but I if there was something in the air, I would sniff it. So I went up to Oxford for a weekend of workshops. I couldn't go at the very beginning, the walk from Wales, because I was doing a boat building course that I'd waited for a couple of years to be on, because every year, funnily enough, there were about 16 people on the course and they only took one woman. It was just coincidence that every year there was one woman. And so it took me a few years to get on the course. But as soon as that was finished, I hitched off up to Oxford with my boat building toolbox, which was very heavy. Of course, at that time, after a couple of months of the women being at Greenham or the people being at Greenham, there were things going on everywhere. There were the new peace groups setting up, and Campaign Atom was already fully active in Oxford, big peace group. And I went to one of their workshops, and there I met a very wonderful woman called Caroline, who you may have come across, one of the women who walked from Greenham, from Wales, from Bawdy. And she almost, even though I'd intended to hitch down to Greenham anyway the following week, she almost headhunted me. I think she liked that I had a sense of humour, that I clearly wasn't a separatist, that I wore pretty 40s dresses with welly boots, which was the uniform of the day in Cornwall, if you're a vegan, welly boots. And I went down to Greenham with another friend of hers from Oxford called Annie, who gave me a lift, which was very nice. And that was it, really. So I was there a couple of months after the women arrived,
So
the
quite
end of the
early.
winter. Yes, perhaps 3 months, but the end of the winter, I think, or the middle of the winter.
Because she went in the winter.
I think so, yes, it was very cold, yes. But I remember I was, even though it's Cornish, I was used to living outside. So it wasn't, to me, it wasn't new. And I don't necessarily like living in mud and rain, but I was used to it.
And what was it like when you got there? What was it like in
It was
those early
quite
days?
quiet. It wasn't like, the big times when there was hundreds of women turning up to snip gates, and quite a lot of the times quite boring. I mean, there was always a lot of, picketing of the cars going by, the vehicles going by, and occasionally there'll be snippeting of fences. But there was a lot of sitting around trying to get the fire going and making cups of tea. And I, being me, used to go off for walks in the countryside. It was a new part of the world for me. So, footpaths down south to Burghclere and Kingsclere and all those places to watch wildlife, which I was more interested in, really. Lots of heavy discussion, even from that period. Men still living at the camp in a support role.
Oh, really? Staying over?
Yes, oh yes, up until Embrace the Base. And I was in a little group that, with Caroline and others, sort of 8 or 9 or 10 of us, that comprised the support men. They were definitely in the support role. They were the few that were there were incredibly gentle, incredibly dedicated, incredibly hardworking. The trouble was that if they did a lot of wood chopping, that was machismo. If they didn't do any chopping, they were lazy gits. So I didn't consider it very non-violent, and the little group that that was my orbit, the women, also didn't consider it very non-violent. And that in the end was why we left. Because the decision to go entirely women only after Embrace the Base was for some women an expedience, a political expedience, which is fine, but it wasn't admitted to be such. It was all about women standing up for their own values and for nurturing and the rest of it, but no admittance of the fact that they've ill-treated men who weren't doing any harm.
That's so interesting, because I thought from other interviews that that the men, that was quite an early decision after they arrived, only a few days after the march had arrived, that it would be women only, and that there would be, and so to hear it's quite a lot later than that, and that men had lived there for a while.
Well, I told you I'd give you the unauthorised version.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's
men were only in supporting roles from almost, I believe, the outset.
Yeah.
And when I was there, men were only in supporting roles. And on the day of, in December, of Embrace the Base, our little group, because we were very down-to-earth folk, I think, we dug all the latrines for Embrace Space. Took us about 12 hours. The water table was very, very high at Greenham. And so as soon as you dug a ditch, well, a trench, huge trenches, they'd fill up with water again. It was a winter. And our little group that dug those latrines were mixed. And at the end of Embrace Space, 3 o'clock in the morning, the couple of men in that group were told to bugger off. So it still makes me cry, really.
Yes.
So we left.
You left with them in solidarity.
Yeah, we'd been planning to set, because at that time also there was an expansion of camps all over Britain, or especially southern Britain, and we were planning to set up another camp in the southeast of England to spread the idea of peace camps. You know, not everybody at Greenham was ill-treated, the few men that were still there supporting, but there was a little core that was a bit Stalinist.
Okay.
In their attitude. There was all sorts of women there who wanted it. The great majority of women wanted it to be women only, but for different reasons, for political expediency, for having a safe women's only space, because of the joy of being amongst only women. So, I'm not coming down hard on Greenham as an idea. I just think...
It sounds like it's not even about the idea of women-only space for you. You can see the value of that. It's about the way those particular men who were there at that time
were perhaps
disposed of.
I'd been involved in lots of sort of short and long-term groups of direct activists and affinity groups that had been mixed and, in very, very nurturing, loving communities of, men and women together. So, to me, it wasn't necessary.
Okay. Did you ever go back after you'd left from that point?
Yeah, we went back for action. So we went up and set up another base, and indeed I visited another camp that I had friends who'd set up as well. We went back for the actions. In May, I can't remember when all the things were, and for some of the blockades, yeah. Oh, yeah, we didn't cut ourselves off from it.
No.
Anything like that. It sounds very, very extreme, but it wasn't as bad as that. No.
Yeah.
But I've been involved in things quite early on. I mean, we did a fast for to raise money for the Windscale Inquiry when I was first at the the Art College down here in Cornwall.
What's the Windscale?
The Windscale Inquiry was 1974. It was an inquiry into the expansion of what is now called Sellafield, but was Windscale until...
Oh.
I don't know when, until the 80s, sometime in the 80s, I can't remember. Can't think of the word, but never mind.
So the nuclear power plants.
Huge public inquiry. Yeah. And at the end of that, there was a big rally in Trafalgar Square late 74 or early 75, I can't really remember. Probably organised by Friends of the Earth, I can't remember. And at that, it was announced that there was a campaign to stop a new nuclear power station being built in East Lothian, south of Edinburgh. And I got very, very involved in that. Over the next year or two or three, and in fact got chucked out of the art college as a result of spending all my time up in East Lothian. So that was my first sort of big involvement in things, really. So and huge occupations, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of people coming to occupy the site and to do direct action, which again you were saying about earlier about people not knowing about earlier non-violent direct actions, but affinity groups from all over Britain going to a place south of Edinburgh, a long, long way from Cornwall, a long, long way from the south of England as well, to take direct action.
And what sort of form did that take? Because I think a lot of people listen to these interviews. It's quite hard to sort of sum up what non-violent direct action is.
Well, the big event at Torness, I was involved in an affinity group from Bristol, Bath area, and I was the little offshoot in.
Would you explain affinity groups as well?
Affinity groups, usually between 8 and 12 people, something like that, that come together, maybe through friendship or neighbourhood or maybe on purpose, to learn how to break the law, really. You don't have to break the law to be in an affinity group. But non-violent direct action against whatever. So you learn how to physically cope with being arrested or being attacked. You learn physically how to deal with human beings emotionally and, you know, tactically how you face off or unface off police and all those things. So
oh wow, that's really interesting.
So which is, you know, millions and millions of lots and lots of affinity groups are now happening for Extinction Rebellion. So, and you know, many of those people think it's new, but of course it's not. There's nothing new under this sun. I wish there was a sun today. So we went up to Torness and there was probably, I don't know, 20 or 25, I don't really remember, different affinity groups from all over Britain taking direct action at this site, which was being built. So the building wasn't up yet, but they'd built they'd dug out the reactor core, which is like sort of a quarter of a mile across. You know, there's a huge hole in the ground, like Delibold Slate Quarry. The thing that our affinity group did was find a water supply, find hoses, and tried to fill the reactor core with water. We didn't really succeed. We put a decent sized puddle in there. Other people were digging up the roads that had been built, you know, the mud roads. I remember on the day, some persons who shall definitely remain anonymous put some sugar in some works vehicles on site, big works vehicles, you know, sort of JCB type things and caterpillars, and I think set fire to one or two vehicles. And there was a huge long discussion about whether that was non-violent or not, because it was not a living thing, and so that took a lot of energy.
But it might have hurt someone else in the process, and I bet views were quite split on that.
God, I've got a photo of somewhere of a group sitting in a circle with hands in the air, waving, gesticulating, and a little ball of smoke in the background where the people is and stuff.
That's
amazing. In-depth discussion. So,
And where did you fall in that discussion, if you can remember?
I never did anything like that, but I wasn't really fussed about machinery.
What was your experience of the police and law in that? It sounds like you've done so many things. That you must have been arrested at some point.
Yeah, a few times. It depends where. In Scotland, the police tended to arrest you and dump you in the countryside because it was, you know, it was near a town called Dunbar, which is about, I suppose, the size of Penryn, probably, or Penryn pre-university. But very rural otherwise, and so you'd have a sort of 3 or 4 or 5 mile walk back through the snow to the site again.
And no paperwork for them sort of thing.
Yeah, of course, yes. It was just a way of putting you off, really. Yeah. I've always built good relationships with the police when I've been living somewhere and getting to know people. At Burfield, the peace camp we set up when we left Greenham, we built, you know, quite deep and profound relationships with the mod plods, the MOD policemen at the site.
How come? How did that?
Because we were living there, and because the ethos of being at Burfield was to actually bring to light the site, which was supposed to be a secret site, but actually to build relationships and change people's minds through discussion. So that wasn't just the local community, it was the mod plods, many of whom were things like ambulance drivers who couldn't afford to be an ambulance driver anymore, so they'd become an MOD policeman because it was a bit more reliable in terms of pay and employment. I've come across a lot of police and prison officers who, you know, why I might laugh at their naivety in my eyes, have said they do the job in order to help people.
Really?
Yeah. So the young ones, anyway.
Yeah.
And yeah, we were very friendly at Burfield, very friendly. You know, when I was on the last Extinction Rebellion thing I did, we chatted to the police, much against the stuff that's laid down by Extinction Rebellion. Don't talk to the police, you might give something away at your court for your court case. But
okay.
The police may be institutionally racist, but if every single police officer, whether they're racist or not, is beyond redemption, what does it say for the rest of society? Because they're only other members of society.
Yeah.
So, it's not non-violent to regard other individuals as
inherently harmful.
Inherently, yes, absolutely, yes, by and large.
I agree. So do you take the... It sounds like you really have embodied the principles of non-violent direct action as part of your personal political...
Well, non-violence. Direct action in my day-to-day life, I don't take a lot of...
No, you know, fair
maybe
enough,
illegal
of course.
Direct action. But non-violence, yes, which is all about treating human beings and giving them a way... It's about giving them a way out as well.
Yeah.
To come back from perhaps something they're doing which you might disapprove of deeply.
And that they, on some level, are hopefully uncomfortable with.
And also, I mean, you know, Burfield was founded on no means to ends, which was what
does
we
that
felt.
Mean?
Well, you don't. The expedience goes out the door, and it's very, you know, almost impossible to live your life entirely without means to ends.
Right.
I'm going to tread on this worm because I need to get to that side of the bridge. You know, whatever.
Okay.
But. You know, what I've been saying about Greenham, about how the men were treated, in order to gain the expedience of a women's only camp, which did a huge amount for the peace movement in terms of publicity and, you know, changing people's lives.
And a huge amount for women of that generation.
Yeah, it was an expedience to treat the men the way they did. So that's why at Burfield we had a lotus symbol, a Buddhist lotus symbol, even though we weren't all Buddhists, as our symbol of the camp. And that, you know, that was quite deep non-violence, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting. So how many of you were living at Burfield?
Burfield, yeah. Only usually about between 8 and 12, I think. It was about a core group of 8 or 9 of us.
That is quite intense, isn't it?
Yeah, it was quite intense. Every day, I think, in the end of the day, I think we sat down and discussed the day and what we'd achieved or not achieved. And every day we discussed one person, how they were feeling. And so, you know, we were quite an intense group. There were other people who came and supported from... It was only about 4 miles from Reading.
Right.
The village of Burfield was half a mile away. I don't know. So lots of people coming and going.
Yeah.
Reading University. But, yeah, there was a core group. Yeah.
And how did it feel if you were the person that was being discussed?
I didn't like it at all, but I'm sort of a bit, you know, sort of a bit, oh, no problem with me. Oh, I don't need anything discussing about me. I'm all right. Oh, all right, Jack. I didn't like it very much, but I also think it was very useful.
Did you hear things that were useful, do you think, or was it...
If I'm honest, I can't really remember.
That's fair enough.
It's a long time ago.
You just remember not much liking having the spotlight on you.
No.
How did you feel about commenting on other people? Or was the whole process slightly uncomfortable?
No, I don't think so. I think I probably preferred it to be commenting on me. Yeah, I think it's probably, it's probably a bit more like gossip when you're talking about other people.
Yeah. So how long did you live there for?
Only, I think less than 6 months, about 6 months. Again, the Falklands War was setting off. Two of the core group were going to go on the peace walk from, I can't remember where it started, it probably started in different places in Europe, to the Balkans, Balkan Peace March,
okay,
which was, I suppose, later to. And so the group was going to be very reduced in size, and we'd done the job we wanted to do, which was getting the people of Burfield who worked at the site thinking about their work. Making Burfield a public site, because it doesn't... I don't know if it does now. I don't suppose it still does. It doesn't appear on OS maps.
Oh, really?
It literally doesn't. You might as well put a mallard duck there instead. It was removed in the 80s. It was removed from the OS map. Oh, no, it was removed earlier from the OS maps. And then it was removed from the registry, the land registry, in the 80s, I think.
Wow.
So it literally doesn't exist. It's the final assembly point for all Britain's nuclear warheads.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so it's in a trio of lovely places. Burfield, Aldermaston, and Greenham, basically.
Wow.
So the trundling. And of course, Nuclear Convoy is coming through the Berkshire Roads to get there and leave it.
Did you ever take part in Cruise Watch, which was kind of awesome?
No, I never did. We watched the missile that we came across. Although we tried very hard to find them, but we came across a couple by accident of the convoys coming into Burfield.
Oh, really?
Late at night, yeah.
What was that like?
Well, I suppose a bit surreal, very quiet, no noise, just the noise in the vehicles, lots and lots and lots of lights. I think about, in a convoy, I should think there was probably 15 or 20 vehicles, including the outriders and things. So lots and lots of security, yeah, so... I wouldn't have wanted to rush out and sit in front of them, that's for sure.
No, people did, didn't they?
Cruise, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what were the actions that you felt kind of best aligned with your...
At Greenham?
Well, either at Greenham or anything else that you've done, because it sounds like you've involved lots of things. And what are the actions you did sort of feel that best reflected your...
I think Burfield was great in that it did this thing of all of a sudden in national papers people knew about this assembly point, you know, which was great.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, I think the most useful thing I ever did was definitely, with the same affinity group I was talking about from earlier on, was we brought to public attention the dumping of nuclear waste at sea 300 miles off the Cornish coast.
That's a big deal.
And again, it hadn't really been... low-level nuclear waste was every year taken in, you know, by train from Windscale and other parts of Heysham and other parts of Britain to a non-unionised little docks in on the Severn, Barclay.
Oh my God!
Where the castle is, and loaded onto a ship and taken out to sea in just oil drums, and dumped in a deep trench. It's now, of course, none of it's there anymore.
I was going to say, is it still there?
Of course not. It's, you know, one of the slow poisonings we've done to the earth and the water and the oceans. Yes. And we did that. And what was great about that is we were a together group who strategised. We planned a campaign. We started by talking to the local villagers, the dockers. We did a march through town and then over the village. And then we did a little blockade of the docks. And the next year we did a much bigger blockade of the train, much more heavily organized. So we had a beginning, a middle and an end. The last action we did got a huge amount of publicity and it got, then Greenpeace took it up. The National Union of Seamen took it up. And after National Union of Seamen took it up, it only took about 6 months for waste dumping to be stopped. So we actually...
That's amazing.
Yeah, so that actually had,
profound effects. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
That's one of the things that I'm really interested in about Greenham is that it was, as activism goes, it was, you could argue it was very successful in terms of its broad aims were no more cruise missiles and get the common land back. Those were both achieved, you know, arguably by the Greenham or not, but I mean, they have happened.
Yes.
And that sounds like a similar thing. It's like a quantifiable success.
Yeah, also in a sense, a much smaller thing than cruise missiles because, you know, if you have a union that doesn't want to handle something so profoundly against its its other statements of intent and doesn't like the idea of non-unionised seamen as well, they were a powerful lot then.
But it shows all the links to... human rights, peace, socialism, like the power of why one union, and like the fact that you said they were targeting a non-unionised workplace start to do something so illegal and detrimental.
Yeah, so...
It's sort of all quite connected, isn't it?
I would argue that probably Greenham didn't stop. It wasn't really responsible for INF.
Right, okay.
I don't think it was at all, but nevertheless, it had
Do you not think it influenced the public dialogue or the international dialogue around?
Maybe a modicum. It did a huge amount for women's empowerment and for people's empowerment as well. But I think INF came at a time when you had these two geezers who came along who bizarre, or three geezers who came along who clicked bizarrely, you know, Thatcher, Gorbachev and Reagan. Yeah. And it was all about, you know, saving money.
Yeah.
And actually making the world a safer place, you know, it was a sort of real politic. I think Green contributed a little, but...
So what do you think its positive impacts were then? Because you did mention its effect on women and people.
Well, you know, millions of women who went back and refused to, you know, be women cosy at home cooking dinner, basically. Or tens of thousands anyway. Maybe.
Yeah.
That changed lots of women's lives, huge amounts of the numbers of women decided to go to university, to do other things that they wouldn't have dreamt doing. That obviously had knock-on effects on men as well, who decided it wasn't right to treat the woman as a little chattel. But also, you know, in terms of, you know, direct action against the state, you know, what was possible and what wasn't. Incredibly empowering to do things that, you know, stop 38-ton, you know, sort of armoured trucks that make you realise that human beings are equal in terms of things like the police and the... Mm. And just, you know, for a lot of women, meeting different people that they'd never meet before.
Yeah.
Know, sort of, that otherwise. So, of course, it's empowering, but...
I notice that you've got sort of XR stuff upon the window, and you're still obviously very involved in movements now. Do you think there's lessons from Greenham that relate to that, or is XR doing similar things to some of the stuff that came out of Greenham for people and for the environment?
Well, there's obviously, you know, a level of direct action. I think XR is wonderful. I think it's so all encompassing that it's muddied its own waters. It doesn't really know where it's going, I don't think.
Right.
I haven't been that involved in it. I've been involved in the last few months and for the last year on and off because I've been in a situation of flux, which is nothing to do with anything else. So I've been very uninvolved in things, in fact. I think it struggles with doing anything which doesn't seem like direct action to it because it considers it too unradical. That's very bad English. It struggles to actually, local groups struggle to strategize what they want to do. They decide they want to do something somewhere and they don't even really know why, let alone how, or have a timeline or a time scale or a set of ideas about who they need to influence and what they need to get in order to achieve it. So a lot of the spontaneous stuff happens anyway and really wonderfully, but I struggle with working with people who don't really think it's important to do the strategy stuff, to have aims and objectives and strategy and tactics. So
yeah.
I think that will come in time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, not that people have had any time.
No. Who do you feel is doing that then? Are there people involved in your life that you can strategize with? Or?
No, not really. No. Not in terms of MVDA, anyway, not violent direct action, no.
Really?
No.
So where's that gone, do you think?
Oh, well, I think, well, they're doing the direct action, so they're the show where it is. The other things that are happening are not necessarily practical action things. There's, you know, there's huge amounts of research going on, there's huge amounts of alternative art and theatre, there's Dark Mountain and all things like that going on, which are not about direct action. But,
so it's almost like the two worlds of... Where perhaps Burfield and Greenham places, there might be a strategy and NVDA together, the practical and the aims and objectives. Mm. And perhaps, and in your impression, like the way you're seeing it at the moment, it's almost like they've separated out into two areas.
No, not really. I don't really think so. No, I just think there's a lot going on. And climate change is it. Climate change and species extinction is...
Yeah.
Is everything.
Yeah.
It's economy and history and geography and
patriarchy.
Culture and it's everything. And even, you know, horrible party politics. So it's obviously gonna take place in lots of different, or we hope in lots of different places and in lots of ways and means. So
what do you, if you just thinking more generally about perhaps not just Greenham but the kind of action you've been involved in the widest sort of scale, if people are going to make that into art or fictionalise it in some way, how would you want that to be portrayed? What are the important premises?
For me, all the best things were funny.
Oh, really?
Well, the fact that yeah, Green and my little group had a laugh, and Seven Sidelines also, we had a really good laugh. Luxillium, we had a really good laugh, and I'm only interested in you know, in things that aren't too serious. So perhaps there could be a sitcom. It would make a hilarious sitcom, although it'd probably be bad. There was a very serious part of Greenham where there was a lack of humour,
yeah,
which I found very difficult.
Was that particularly Greenham, or is that activism in general? Because the issues can
be
so.
It was Greenham. You couldn't make a joke about feminism.
Right.
Or women. I could joke about anything else, but not women.
I'm saying Greenham as if it's one thing, but actually it's lots of different gates,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yes.
So which gate were you?
Well, when I was there, it was only really... well,
because early on,
it was the main gate, which was...
yellow.
Yellow, yeah. Yes, yellow. So the I don't think it was called yellow then, though.
No, I think it's still main.
Yes,
and the
then,
was,
then Fran, my mate Fran, sat at the green gate. But I think that was already called green... but it was quite near to Yellow Paint. It was very near. I think it was a bit to the west. I can't really remember the layout. I can remember where the main gate was. But yeah, so the colours of the gates, I think, only came with Embrace the Base.
Oh, really?
I think. I can't really remember. Yeah. So it wasn't anybody else then. I think on the day of Embrace the Base, the men were told to go and do things at the Purple Gate.
Oh,
go
really?
To the Purple Gate and make us sandwiches or something like that. I can't remember. I might be wrong in the colour of the gate.
I have definitely heard about the sandwich making, though.
Yes.
I've met my dad. I mean, you know my mum and dad.
Yes.
And my dad was definitely a sandwich maker.
Sandwiches.
He was making sandwiches and part of the creche.